from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, with the conviction of former Liberian leader Charles Taylor and the creation of President Obama's new Atrocities Prevention Board, genocide prevention has gained renewed international attention. We'll discuss current efforts to prevent genocide around the world with guests including Gregory Stanton, who is president of Genocide Watch and a research professor in genocide studies and prevention at the School of Conflict Analysis and Resolution at George Mason University. We'll also be joined by Congresswoman Barbara Lee, who is now chairing the Congressional Sudan Caucus, and refugees from Sudan and Cambodia will join us as well after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. With Genocide Watch in San Francisco recently, an organization dedicated to preventing, stopping, and punishing genocide, and a guilty verdict rendered just last week against former Liberian strongman Charles Taylor, we want to discuss genocide in this opening Forum hour. And President Obama, in fact, recently established a new Atrocities Prevention Board, giving more international attention to the ongoing concern over massacres that continue to occur in places like Syria, Chechnya, Iraq, Republic of Congo, and the Sudan. This morning's opening Forum hour, we turn our attention once again to genocide and look at ways to prevent it. With us in studio is Gregory Stanton. He is research professor in genocide studies and prevention at the School for Conflict Analysis and Resolution at George Mason University, and also president of Genocide Watch. And welcome. Good morning.
Good to be with you.
Good to have you with us. We also have Yasser Khoury here with us in studio, a former Sudanese refugee, now a United States citizen, founded Nuba Vision Coalition, a nonprofit that seeks to unite Nuba entities and organizations to act for common good and rebuild the Nuba region. Welcome.
Thank you.
Glad to also have Chivi Sok with us, who is a human rights advocate and child survivor of the Khmer Rouge killing fields. Welcome.
Good morning.
And Barbara Lee, Congresswoman who represents the 9th District and now co-chairs the Congressional Sudan Caucus, will also be joining us in the program later on. Let me begin, if I may, Professor Stanton, with you. And let's talk about last week's, major news in many ways, the verdict against Charles Taylor, 5 years aiding and abetting war crimes in Sierra Leone and found guilty. Unprecedented for a head of state to be found guilty like this. It's promising, and yet at the same time, not found guilty for crimes of command and control.
You know, what it did was it expanded, however, the range of crimes for which people can be found guilty. In that way, it was like the ICTY's finding in Kursich, who was directly involved in the Srebrenica massacre. So in a way, it expanded the reach of international humanitarian criminal law. So in some ways, it was a very good thing because it said to the top commanders, look, we don't have the actual papers in which you issued the orders, but your pattern of systematic actions is enough to convict you, and you aided and abetted these crimes.
11 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Is it safe to say, though, that this is the tip of the iceberg as far as genocidal things that are going on throughout the globe?
It is the tip of the iceberg. But, of course, Charles Taylor was a serial genocidist, as most of them are. He had already committed genocide, of course, in other places, in his own country, in Liberia. And so, and that's typical of these kinds of people. In Sudan, for instance, the regime there in power, the Bashir regime, has now committed 4 genocides.
And in fact, as we speak here, and we'll talk about this with Yasser Khoury, there's an attempt to bring some kind of negotiation between the North and the South in Sudan in the civil war that's gone on there. But one often looks at massacres and mass killings and genocide with a great deal of horror and also feelings of intense and profound frustration. I must tell you, someone who's been doing this work as a journalist for many years and bringing things into the light, when we talk about prevention of genocide, many of us feel helpless.
I completely understand that. In fact, addressed that in the speech that I gave to the rally we had here yesterday. There are even studies by psychologists that show just how difficult it is for us to identify and sympathize with people halfway around the world. The answer to that is we have to create permanent institutions that will watch out for, that will take preventive action against, that will stop, and that will punish these kinds of crimes.
The United Nations fails in doing that, really.
The United Nations utterly fails to do that. They haven't failed completely because they did, after all, create the Yugoslav and the Rwandan tribunals. But on the whole, if you want to prevent genocide, regional alliances are far more effective.
Well, you write about eight stages of genocide. Early prevention is one of them, and that has to do often with classifying people, finding common ground of how people can essentially, as things begin to develop along this trajectory, be eliminated and exterminated.
That's right. The first stage is classification, the us versus them stage. If you can stop it there, you've stopped it. In other words, Hitler's first job was to take citizenship away from the Jews in Germany. If they'd been able to stop him there, they would have stopped him. And then the second stage is symbolization, because we have to give names to these.
Or yellow stars.
Yellow stars. The third is organization, because it always has to be organized. The fourth is dehumanization, in which you dehumanize the people you're going to kill. You know, call them vermin or cockroaches or whatever.
Let me stop and ask you a question there, because in reading about these, you talk about dehumanization as think about radio stations in Rwanda, for example, talking about insects and the conflict between Hutus and the Tutsis. Do you shut down? You talk about shutting down these radio stations.
Yes.
I mean, there's hate talk and dehumanization in radio stations here in the United States.
And I fully believe that although we have a different type of system, which I think makes it unnecessary to shut those radio stations down, because we have a sort of a Jeffersonian democracy in which, you know, the idea is that opposing radio stations will counter what they're having to say. In societies that are committing genocide or about to commit genocide, they have only one source, you know, the official radio station. In Rwanda, we had an actual hate radio station that was literally targeting people. And at the cost of merely $8,000 an hour, the U.S. government could have jammed that radio station. $8,000 an hour times 24 hours a day times 100 days, which it took to kill 800,000 people. You figure out how much we value to each human life in that country.
The United States could have gone into Rwanda much sooner than it did, just like Bosnia, too, but it didn't. And now we're facing similar questions with Syria and on it goes. But let me go back to these eight steps or these eight stages that you talk about, because after dehumanization comes polarization.
That's correct.
And then prevention.
That's correct.
Preparation.
Preparation.
And then extermination. It seems to follow this paradigm, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah. It does. And, you know,
explain each of those if you could.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Preparation actually has two stages, really, within it. The preparation part on the part of the perpetrators is the planning, the conspiracy, and so forth. The Wannsee Conference, you know, the plans that are made. The other side of preparation is the persecution of the victim group, where they herd people off into ghettos, concentration camps, march them out into the desert as they did to the Armenians, things of that kind. The extermination stage, of course, then, is the actual genocide. It's when the lawyers can say, oh, this is genocide. Genocide Watch doesn't wait until then. We say, look, you've got to stop it before then. It's too late if it's already started.
And there's one more stage, and that is, and you alluded to it indirectly when you talk about marching Armenians into the desert, because I've talked to people like the Turkish ambassador and others who deny that there was any extermination against the Armenians, and denial is one of the stages.
That's correct. The final stage of every single genocide is denial, and it even begins at the beginning of the genocide.
But genocide is one of those words that's become kind of a floating signifier now. People use it widely. They talk about cultural genocide. They talk about, let's say, the killing of six people, eight people, even as genocide. Where do you begin to define in a definitive way what genocide is as opposed to what it is not?
Well, we follow the Genocide Convention, which says—
Human Rights Convention. The UN—
the UN Convention on Genocide, which says that genocide is the intentional destruction in whole or in part, never forget the in part, of a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group as such. Now, Genocide Watch doesn't get into these debates about whether it was genocide or not, if it was because it was political reasons or social reasons or economic reasons. We think that the communist mass killing was just as bad as what Hitler did. So we believe that Lemkin was right, that those groups should have been included in the Genocide Convention as well.
You mentioned Raphael Lemkin in 1944 began to define, it was the working definition at Nuremberg.
That's correct.
And it remains a working definition. Do you include something like North Korea?
I do indeed. I think North Korea, which is for the most part political killing, can be called genocidal as well. They have 200,000 people in a gulag that resembles Stalin's. They have a million-man army. They're armed to the teeth. They have nuclear weapons. In fact, it's very close to the top of our risk countries right now because we believe that eventually the Korean people are going to rise up against that government and that the Korean government will have no qualms at all about killing literally a million people.
We're talking with Gregory Stanton, who's a research professor in genocide studies and prevention with the School for Conflict Analysis and Resolution at George Mason University and president of Genocide Watch. Getting more organized, getting more impact in terms of preventing, are you?
I think a lot because, you know, this, for example, creation of the Atrocities Prevention Board by President Obama and appointing Samantha Power, who is really the right person to appoint for this, as the chair of it, and having a rotating system within the government to actually keep watch. I think that's exactly the kind of institutionalization we need, and we want, in fact, that to be created in many other governments as well.
Can you also talk about the Kony 2012 video? Because that went viral, and that certainly had impact, hasn't it?
It did. It did, and did indeed. In fact, it resulted, I believe, along with the efforts of Invisible Children and Enough and a number of other organizations in the 2010 act by Congress to authorize the dispatch of U.S. special forces to train the Ugandan military to hunt down Kony and to bring him to justice.
Let's speak with a couple of survivors of genocide who are here with us. Studio. Yasser Khoury is a former Sudanese refugee, now a U.S. citizen, founded Nuba Vision Coalition. First of all, a lot of people don't know about Nuba, about the Nuba people in the mountains. Tell us.
Okay. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to speak to you. Actually, the Nuba Mountain is one of the remotely isolated region of the central part of Sudan. People never know what is going on in the Nuba Mountain. It's my privilege to talk to you today about the Nuba Mountain, which is very important place where people ignore it in the world. A place where genocide has been taken place long, long time ago, and nobody has ever talked about it. I am delighted to tell you today there is a genocide going on in the Nuba Mountain. Not for the first time, but it is second time genocide has taken place in the Nuba Mountain. Since the first one is 1992, and the latest one, which has increasingly become exacerbated, is started June 2011.
And this is one of the four
genocide was described
by Professor Stanton talked about under the leadership of Omar al-Bashir. You have fled you fled Sudan as a Christian, in fact, did you not?
Sure, yes. One of the major reasons that compelled me to flee the Sudan is a political activity that I was performing. And as a matter of my religious belief, I was being persecuted. Finally, due to the discontentment that's taking place there, and I didn't satisfy with that life, I was decided to flee the country because of that persecution I went through. I flee the country, crossed the border, and I was lucky to be received by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees to be accepted as a refugee in a camp where I stayed a couple months, approximately 9 months. I finally accepted to come to the United States as a refugee.
Well, that's your good fortune and ours to have you here as a citizen now. But you've been talking about things that people have been talking about for quite some time. No-fly zone in Darfur and humanitarian relief getting through in Darfur. And we've seen very little progress, haven't we?
Yeah, of course, when I talk about no-fly zone, I want something to happen like what happened. Immediate action was taken in Libya. But why not Sudan? We have been telling the world, why you forget Sudan, especially the Nuba Mountains? Darfur have been quiet. Many people know about the Darfur, But the Nuba Mountain, people has never talked about the Nuba Mountains. I need that action to be taken. An international community should aware there is a dangerous situation going on in the Nuba Mountains.
Again, Yasser Khoury is a former Sudanese refugee, now a U.S. citizen, and founded the Nuba Vision Coalition, a nonprofit that seeks to unite Nuba entities and organizations to act for common good and rebuild the Nuba region. Let's talk about more of the Sudan. Congresswoman Barbara Lee, now on the line with us, represents United States Congress here in Northern California in the 9th District and is co-chair of the Congressional Sudan Caucus. Congresswoman, good to have you with us. Good morning.
Glad to be with you this morning.
Let's begin by talking about, you're going to be meeting with Susan Rice, that's coming up?
You know, we met with Ambassador Rice Friday, and it was a very good meeting. It was members of the Sudan Caucus and other interested members who have been involved or want to get involved on our response to what is taking place now. And I'm going to tell you, if we don't do more, and if the world community does not do more, 500,000 lives, you know, hang in the balance. I believe that the United States needs to push extremely hard to try to do a few things. First, bring both sides to the table to try to reduce the tensions. And so I think it's up to us to continue to really forge that type of, strategy. Secondly, the AU has developed a proposal at the United Nations, and Ambassador Rice indicated that right now we have to get, you know, everyone to agree to this proposal, to the AU proposal, because the elements of the AU proposal, she believes, will really bring a peaceful resolution to the conflict. And finally, the third point is that we've got to make sure that the supply routes for humanitarian aid are opened up and that we're able to get the food and medicine and what we need in there, because people are already facing hunger, and with the rainy season coming, it's going to be desperate. And so we've got to really, those three things, I think the United States needs to really forge ahead and push on very quickly.
What about this new Atrocities Prevention Board headed up by Samantha Powers, which you already heard about from Professor Gregory Stanton here? Are you hopeful that that will make some kind of serious impact?
Yes, I am. I'm not sure what the overall agenda is with that. But any board, any organization, any commission that is pushing forward to try to bring a resolve to this, I think makes a lot of sense. I've got to look at the details of what their actual mission is. I did not hear the professor talk about the details of that. But I can tell you, I'm confident that what, you know, our government is doing, what the White House and the UN and State Department is doing is really very useful at this place.
What tools do we really have, though? I mean, what tools do the United States have to stop this killing that's going on, particularly in Darfur? I mean, it's been going on in the Sudan region now for lo, these many years.
Yeah, and I've been to Darfur on three occasions, and I've witnessed the genocide in Darfur taking place as it was taking place, and it was just horrendous. And the world was very slow to come to the point of, and even to this day, some don't believe it was genocide that was taking place. But fortunately, you know, the late Honorable Donald Payne really pushed hard to get this declaration of genocide in Darfur. And I worry that, you know, and I hope this doesn't happen now with this latest, outbreak. And then really, we're on Sudan and South Sudan, they are on the brink of war. And so I think the United States has several tools, though, that we need to employ in a more assertive way. And one is getting China. And we've mentioned this. Actually, I led in a letter. We had 68 signatures, and we urged the Secretary of State to use the meeting this week in China to really have China play a more active role, to really, because they're a pivotal player, you know, in what the International Crisis Group has called.
They pretty much ignored things up to now, Congresswoman.
Yeah, but I know, but we can't let them ignore it anymore. You know, they're giving South Sudan $8 billion for development and infrastructure, and we need to use our leverage. And I'm not sure the United States has used its leverage with China, because China and Russia and other countries that we're very close to need to step up, because China's the key player in Sudan and South Sudan.
And what about bringing justice to the Sudanese people? I mean, Omar al-Bashir has a warrant out. Is it ongoing unlikely that he will receive justice?
Well, he should. You know, we have witnessed Charles Taylor last week.
Yeah.
being convicted. Bashir has been indicted by the International Criminal Court. And for the life of me, I can't understand why he is still actually the president of Sudan. You know, he, you know, has the indictment lays out the atrocities that he has committed. And I think sooner or later, you know, he's got to come before the court for his trial.
And what about the fact that a lot of the emphasis in terms of genocidal crimes has really been in the continent of Africa? I mean, certainly now we're seeing, are we not seeing a genocide in Syria? And as Professor Stanton said, North Korea. But it seems like the ICC particularly is putting a lot of its lasering on Africa. The ICC, excuse me.
Well, we've seen past genocide. You know, April is Genocide Prevention Month, and we've seen past genocide, of course, in Bosnia, Cambodia, you know, the Holocaust, Rwanda, all over the world. And, you know, we've got to, wherever we witness the beginning of a genocide taking place, we have to step up very quickly and prevent it from happening. And I think that the continent of Africa, we, you know, there are many historical reasons that are unfortunate right now in what we're watching take place there. But certainly, wherever we have leaders who commit genocide against their people, we need to bring them to justice, and we need to move forward with the International Criminal Court. It's unfortunate. I know the United States had pulled out of the ICC. You know, I think it was when President Bush was in, but this is the International Criminal Court that has been established to indict and prosecute those for crimes against humanity, wherever they occur. And so we can't, the world can't stand by and watch a repeat of Darfur anywhere.
Congresswoman Barbara Lee, again, from California's 9th District, co-chair of the Congressional Sudan Caucus. Thank you for joining us, Barbara Lee.
Okay, thank you. Good being with you.
Good to have you. And you can join us, by the way. Let me give out the phone number. If you'd like to join this conversation, you're cordially invited to do so. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls, so feel free to join us now at 866-733-6786. There are a number of other ways to communicate with us. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also go to our Facebook page, and we are going to be talking with Shivi Sock, who's with us as well, a human rights advocate and child survivor of the Khmer Rouge killing fields. Just wanted to get a quick response, though, from you, Gregory Stanton, on, well, essentially what Congresswoman Lee said. She's hopeful, and she's quite positive from the sounds of it about what the United States can do.
But I think she's also realistic. The answer, of course, is the U.S. cannot be the policeman of the world, and so we do have to rely on our regional allies, and I think we have to rely on as many international institutions as we can build. I, for one, for example, think that it is time for an optional protocol to create an international police force to enforce arrest warrants that are issued by the International Criminal Court. I don't mean some black helicopter, you know, police that can just kind of go anywhere they want and arrest anybody they want. I mean a really powerful police force that can only enforce arrest warrants that are issued by the International Criminal Court. It is crazy for Bashir to be able to go to the inauguration of a president in Kenya and not be arrested. Now, as you may know, the Supreme Court in Kenya has now issued an arrest warrant for him there, and if he ever tries to go there again, he will be arrested. But it is this type of impunity, in fact, that encourages genocide. And as we develop those institutions, I think we'll have more of a chance.
Chris, we're coming up on a break here, but many feel that Henry Kissinger could be arrested if he were traveling in Europe, and there's all of these kind of difficulties from the United States perspective, but we'll not go there now. We're going to go back when we return to you, our listeners, and talk with another guest we have here. You can join us toll-free, 866-733-6786. This is Forum. I'm Michael Crest. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. With the conviction of former Liberian leader Charles Taylor and the creation of President Obama's new Atrocities Prevention Board, genocide prevention has gained renewed international attention. This is, in fact, Genocide Awareness Month as we end April. And this hour, we're discussing current efforts to prevent genocide around the world. With us in studio is Gregory Stanton, who is a research professor in genocide studies and prevention at the School for Conflict Analysis and Resolution at George Mason University. He's also president of Genocide Watch. We spoke with Congresswoman Barbara Lee, who is co-chair of the Congressional Sudan Caucus. And with us also in studio is Yasser Khoury, a former Sudanese refugee, now a U.S. citizen who founded Nuba Vision Coalition, a nonprofit that seeks to unite Nuba entities and organizations to act for common good and rebuild the Nuba region, and Chivi Sak, who is a human rights advocate and child survivor of the Khmer Rouge killing fields. And before we go to your calls and emails, I wanted to bring Chivi Sak into the discussion here. You actually came out of the killing fields at, what, age six?
Yes, my family and I survived the period, 1975 to 1979, and we were lucky enough to be one of the few people who escaped it intact. So my immediate family all survived that period.
But the new data shows that for survivors, there's all the trauma, the post-traumatic stress, even going on to the next generation in many instances.
Certainly. What the Cambodians went through has been an immense challenge. First of all, those who were educated were the ones who were killed off. And so you had a lot of people who didn't have that opportunity. And then, of course, being having survived that horrible genocide and then being dropped off into the country with very little to work with. I mean, literally most of us arrived with just the clothes on our back, with no contacts, no network, no resources. And so the challenge has been immense. And then in a situation where society didn't understand what post-traumatic stress syndrome was about. And so, you know, and this is very, very real within my family. People who have headaches for no reason, people who all of a sudden stop seeing because seeing was just too much pain. People who couldn't adjust to the new life that they were, facing. And so they turned to alcohol to cope. And so the layers of challenges are quite immense. And then also culturally, it's very hard to seek help to deal with these kind of problems. And so the idea of therapy is not there. And so the community as a whole is heavily scarred. And many to this day live with severe depression, for example. I know that exists in my family as well.
There's also the challenge, you know, with any genocide or Holocaust, of keeping the memories alive and keeping really the legacy of memory alive. I mean, there are a lot of young people today, younger generation, who probably don't even know who Pol Pot is or what the killing fields were, I imagine, even though there were millions and millions who were slain during that period.
And that happens not just here in the United States, but it's also a problem in Cambodia. Many younger generation, I was there last back in December 2004, and I made it a point to actually go and talk to students at the university, for example. And many of them couldn't believe that things like that happened, that nearly a quarter of the population was killed off. You know, the atrocities just seemed like it was in a movie. It wasn't a part of the real life. And so the need for preservation of memory is very real, partly because it's important for the evidence, for example, for the tribunal, but then partly for the living history and then for education of the future generation and for prevention purposes. I believe in what Gregory has talked about, the need to build institution, but part of the institutional building also requires evidence and memory. And it also affirms the existence of those survivors who went through that horrific period. For some parents, you know, when their children don't believe what happened to them, can you imagine what that does to them? Or people who are in a relationship and having the partner not believing the level of atrocity that they engage, can you imagine the damage that does to a person psychologically?
Well, there's also the lack of justice. Professor Stan talked about denial, and there's been denial in terms of those who were responsible, Khmer Rouge and high officials in these tribunals that have gone on.
Denial at the official level, because it serves a political purpose, but also denial because of the lack of knowledge and understanding of what had actually happened. And yes, a huge implication for justice or lack of justice in this case.
Let's bring our callers in, and we go first to you, Craig. Join us. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. Going back to the 20th century, it seems that genocide seemed to take place often in regions where nationalist fervor is taking place. And I'm curious as to the relationship between nationalism and genocide.
Professor Stanton, some thoughts from you on that?
I think there's a very close relationship. In fact, if you put together three forces, you get genocide: nationalism, racism, and totalitarianism or authoritarianism.
Despotism, yeah.
And in fact, even if you look back at the history of the United States, our nationalistic push to the West, in which we had the doctrine of manifest destiny, was a genocidal ideology. We must never forget our country was born in genocide. This is something we have to
admit. You mean against Native Americans, indigenous people?
Against Native Americans and indigenous people and against our slaves. I mean, the Middle Passage was genocidal. So, you know, when you look at previous history, the building of nations, it does indeed, it is a powerful force for genocide. The example in Cambodia, for example, was that Pol Pot and his cadres believed they were going to recreate the original Khmer Nation and, you know, had to drive out all foreign influences. So what did they do?
They also had to drive out any sense of bourgeois or bourgeoisie.
Absolutely.
Or intellectual.
Yes, yes. All intellectuals to be killed. And, of course, the answer to denial, as Shivi was getting at, is not just to have tribunals, and I was very involved in that because, in fact, it was Cambodia in 1980 that got me started in all of this work when I went there and worked on, you know, the relief program in there. But I was concluded that we had to bring these people to justice, and the reason why was not just so that there would be a historical accounting. It would also be so that the Cambodian people would try to finally understand why these people did these incredible crimes. And then thirdly, that this memory would be able to be part of the Cambodian culture. And we have proposed, in fact, a system by which, you know, the stories, the memories of the Cambodian people be preserved, not only at the national level, but also at the family and at the local temple level.
Well, we have Radovan Karadzic awaiting trial, UN War Crimes Tribunal. We have the head of the Ivory Coast, the chief of state, Laurent Gbagbo, awaiting trial in The Hague. I mean, there are tribunal processes of justice that are at least in the works.
Yes.
As we speak. Let me go to more calls here. Chuck, you're on. Good morning.
Hello. I know long-term solutions require education and political assistance, but short-term, one potential tool, especially in countries like Syria and Sudan, no trees, is the public knowledge that a coalition of UN members with drones will send an unarmed drone, and in 24 hours, any tank shelling Homs, one tank, but we don't know which one will be hit. And then every 4 hours after that, until they pull back out of the no-kill zone, this is mainly a psychological tool, short-term, stop the bleeding.
Yes, Sir Corey, what would you think about that in the Sudan? We've heard a number of people talking about, helping out actually in a military fashion, the way the caller is suggesting.
There is a lot of possibility that can be taken in terms of preventing a genocide in Sudan. As we have seen, we always call us a Sudanese people a no-fly zone, even though many agreements and many treaties have been signed for preventing a genocide or doing something better for Sudanese. Al-Bashir and his government, totalitarian regime of Al-Bashir, will never honor any agreement. They just see it as something else. So the best thing, you need to empower the community and creating an institutions that will targeting al-Bashir and the said government.
But here's a caller who suggests something along the lines of more direct military invention, like sending drones and that sort of operation.
So I would suggest you can empower local community there or empower the SPLA. There is a Sudan People's Liberation Army, which is capable to protect its own people. If you give us a tool that's unnecessary, we will protect ourselves. Instead of walking around and trying our best, nobody has ever helped us.
Well, I'm reminded, I know, Professor Stan, you want to talk here for a moment, but John Pendergrast has talked about helping the Congo with helicopters and transports and so forth.
Yes, and he's right. And I agree with the caller. Why is it that we seem to take a pacifist approach here? When Bashir is sending his, bombers over the Nuba Mountains and literally killing people and sending in helicopter gunships, our proposal is wait for those bombers to land, wait for those helicopters to land, wait for the people in those helicopters and bombers to get out of them, let them sit at night, and send in cruise missiles from American ships in the Indian Ocean and destroy them. We believe that if you did that, he would finally get the message that we were going to destroy his entire Air Force, one plane by plane.
Let me read some of the comments we're getting from listeners. Listener writes, do you see a danger for the Hazara as an ethnic and religious minority when we leave Afghanistan? They're awful short of friends in the area. I think Iran is the only one they have. Is there something we can do as we leave to the head of a Pashtun campaign against them?
My answer to that is yes, because, in fact, my wife has been in that region, has seen, of course, the Bamiyan sculptures that were blown up by the Taliban, and knows a lot of the Hazara. They've been a persecuted people for many, many years. We have pointed this out, but I think the Hazara need especially protection. They're a minority group inside Afghanistan, and we must make sure that in the Afghan constitution, and for that matter, that they be armed themselves to defend themselves.
A couple comments on our website. Listener writes, when the USA killed 500,000 Iraqis in order to accomplish more or less nothing useful except to boost profits for politically connected military contractors like Halliburton, wasn't that genocide? And aren't Bush and Cheney guilty of genocide? And why is Obama ignoring the international arrest warrant for Cheney? And another listener says, what do you call what's happening in Israel? The slow eradication of the native population to replace it with Eastern Europeans and Americans? Is that not genocide-like? Is there not a kind of ethnic cleansing going on there?
Well, as far as what happened in Iraq, there are two things that have happened. First of all, you had a genocidal regime under Saddam Hussein. There's no question. I mean, he killed about 400,000 Kurds. He also killed probably another 300,000 Shiite Muslims in the southern part of Iraq. In other words, there you had a genocidal regime, no questions asked. The question was how to get rid of Saddam Hussein. Was it right for us to essentially lead the opposition to sort of intervene in Iraq, or was it going to make the situation worse? One of the key questions you have to ask when you're talking about intervention is it going to make it worse? Well, a lot of people can argue it made it worse. Now, the Kurds would not argue that. They're very pro-American, and they have a lot of independence now. But I think you find a lot of Iraqis now really questioning our intervention there. Could Cheney and Bush and Rumsfeld be indicted for war crimes? I believe indeed they could. I think that some of the crimes, and I know this is a really dangerous thing to say, I used to be in the State Department after all. But I think that when you violate fundamental international humanitarian law, and I don't care if it's wartime or not, if when you permit, as they did, torture in Bagram and other places like that, that is a war crime.
Well, there are some who are saying that Obama's committed war crime sending drones in to kill innocent civilians in Pakistan.
I think that's a less clear case because there you have a war and he's using a tactic of war essentially to try to eliminate the leadership of the forces of the al-Qaeda who are—
There are innocent
opponents.
People being killed, though.
Yes, of course there are, and I agree. But I think it's much— a much more questionable case.
What about the listener who mentions Israel as being somehow, I think the phrase he used was genocide-like.
I don't think it's genocide-like because I don't think the objective of Israel is to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group as such. I don't think that's their objective, their goal. It's not their intent. But I do think that the wall and the other kinds of divisions in Israel, and for that matter, the way they've treated the people in the West Bank, has certain aspects of apartheid, has certain aspects of human rights violations that our country should be opposing. We should be basically demanding of Netanyahu that, sorry, but you got to get your people out of the West Bank, and you've got to turn those over to the Palestinians.
Jimmy Sock, before I go to more listeners here, and by the way, you can join us by email forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or go to our Facebook page. You can also join us on the phone at 866-733-6786. We're going to take more of your calls and read more of your comments in just a moment here, but I want to go back to Jimmy Sock and talk about, when you think about the Cambodian horror, the genocide in Cambodia, what do you tell people about moving forward, especially those who are as you suggested, trapped by the past and by the horror of the past?
Well, first of all, I wanted to mention one point quickly, which is sometimes it gets very depressing when you talk about the many failures or challenges in dealing with genocide. And so I just want to bring the conversation back to something that for me was extremely important, which is, you know, although it's important to think about building institutions and courts and all of that, and, you know, as a human rights advocate, I'm 100% behind that. But what we must never forget is the people that is currently living through the challenges. So, for example, when I was in the refugee camp, when we had just escaped Cambodia, you know, I would not have survived had it not been the many efforts in the U.S. and Europe to push so that water could be trucked in. So there are many, many different things that can be done to help people as they currently live through the different challenges. And I don't think that we should ever underestimate that effort. It's because of the humanitarian assistance that I'm able to sit here today and then able to rebuild my life, to go to college and do the work that I do today.
But it's also, I guess, the import of my question, I'm certainly sensitive to what you're saying, and what you say makes a great deal of sense. But I remember meeting with a group called Survivors International, and they were talking about how difficult it is sometimes to simply move forward.
Yes. So this is actually a significant portion of my work currently, because I come from that population and I know what it's like. It is extremely challenging, excruciating at times. And so one of the things that we're trying to do within the Cambodian American community right now is actually building leadership within women. We believe that women really hold the family together and they hold society together, and that if we address their needs and we empower them, that they can actually help to carry the family forward. So, for example, in the Bay Area.
Excuse me, I think Professor Stanton pointed out that most genocides are male-led genocides.
That is correct.
Most governments are male-led, but anyway, just for the record. I'm sorry.
A very stark contrast indeed. And so here within the Bay Area, a group of us decided to start a giving circle called the Devdah Giving Circle, doing exactly just that, working with the survivor population on the most basic of skills, for example, supporting efforts to support family, to have counseling. Within the Bay Area, many families do not have access to that, and so the Giving Circle tries to raise money in order to support organizations that's trying to do that. They are strapped for funds, supporting organizations that are working with girls who are at risk. Now, in Oakland, we have a lot of Cambodian Americans, Southeast Asian Americans, indeed, who are subjected to sexual exploitation. The local grassroots effort is not getting a lot of attention. And so the Devdah Giving Circle, for example, is trying to make that issue more visible, and it's also providing funding so that these girls can have a chance. And then, you know, I should also mention that these girls come from the families where they are, you know, there's a lot of depression, there's a lot of violence, there's a lot of alcoholism. And so the cycle is quite vicious. And so through the intervention with these girls, we hope to break the cycle. And on a more personal level, I know that, you know, the post-traumatic stress syndrome has carried over from my childhood, from my mother to me, and I am fully committed to ending it with me. I have two girls now, and by the time they are grown up, I am going to do everything possible so that it does not transfer to them.
Let me bring more of our callers on. Andre, you're on.
Hi, yes, I'm the executive director of a Berkeley-based nonprofit called Potential Energy, and we work in Darfur, Sudan, providing fuel-efficient cook stoves to women who have to walk to get wood for cooking and are often attacked during those walks. And my question is about the current escalation of the North-South conflict and whether any of your guests have an opinion as to how that might affect Darfur. That's a question we get a lot as an organization, and we get a lot of anecdotal information from our partners on the ground, or when I go there, or when my colleagues go there. But I was wondering if any of your guests have sort of a bigger picture view of how it might affect Darfur.
Yeah, let's hear from Yasser Corey.
Yes, of course. There is a tremendous effect there. North-South conflict is really going to affect a lot of entire regions in Sudan. One of the regions that will be affected is not only Darfur, but the Nuba Mountains. North-South conflict is affecting the Nuba Mountain region of central Sudan, Darfur as well. But we ultimately formed something called a Coalition of Sudan Revolutionary Front. Sudan Revolutionary Front Coalition, which is including Darfur, Blue Nile, Nuba Mountain, all those, they are fighting together. But the problem of Darfur is a little bit because of terrain. The land is so flat and it's easily be affected. In the Nuba Mountain, the terrain is different because we have mountains where we can hide in the caves. So the issue is here very, very challenging.
Let me thank the caller. And here's a listener. Bruce says, who do you propose we send to Sudan, Syria, or Rwanda, or anywhere else suffering from genocide? Our military is exhausted after 15 years of Bush's and Obama's ill-conceived Asian wars. Be careful suggesting U.S. military intervention unless you intend to send your kids into war zones. Easy to sit in the safety of a radio studio urging our troops to take action when you don't have any flesh in the game. Gregory Stanton?
I completely agree with that because my son is a U.S. Marine. And, you know, he was, in fact, a Special Recon Marine in Iraq. So I really feel that we are not the policemen of the world. And I think, in fact, using regional alliances is by far the best way to deal with this. For that matter, I actually think that you got to build genocide prevention from the ground up in the countries at risk. Probably the best example of it is what happened in Liberia, where a group of women actually overthrew Charles Taylor and then got Ellen Johnson Sirleaf elected the first woman president of the country.
Let me get another caller on, and that's you, Helen. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Helen. I'm in Berkeley. My question is regarding Israel. You just briefly discussed, but I wondered if you were aware and what you thought of the work of Ilan Papp, a book entitled The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. Papp is was in Israel as a university professor. It's a very well-researched book, covers the Palestinian exclusion in 1948.
Are you familiar with that, Gregory Stanton?
I've read it, and I actually think that he's on the right track because, you know, the basic problem was that what we have right now is the result of there was a treaty that set the borders of Israel, but then through wars and also through other changes since, Israel's effective control has now extended into the West Bank and so forth, and they've built walls and so forth around these settlements, and I think that it is a real serious problem in that whole region, and it has to be dealt with. Palestinians have a right, I think, to their own state. And I think that we will eventually have that as a result.
Let me thank the caller and move to a caller joining us from Philadelphia. Abby, hi. You're on forum. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning. My question has to do with al-Bashir's indictment by the ICC because it actually went to a pretrial hearing and the judges there ruled that because there was not proof of intent of a genocide beyond a reasonable doubt, that they could not actually bring al-Bashir to trial. And my question is, because he is still the leader of the government of Sudan, how is it possible to go about getting this evidence for intent beyond a reasonable doubt without a regime change?
That ruling by the pretrial chamber was appealed by the prosecutor and was overturned then, after the prosecutor brought in more evidence of his involvement in genocide. And now, in fact, the pretrial chamber has approved an arrest warrant for Bashir for genocide. So, in fact, he is now indicted for genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. The big problem is how the heck do you get him in front of the court? How do you arrest him?
Well, you could have done that in Kenya, as you said earlier.
Yeah, and in other countries, too. And so that's why we need this
traveling around
force.
With impunity, in fact, be told. Yeah.
It's outrageous.
One would think maybe the African Union could play some role in this.
One would think.
Let me get another caller on here. That's you, Danielle. Hi.
Oh, hello. I've just been trying to keep up on the situation in Libya. I know there's been, it seems to me like it could be called ethnic cleansing of the city of Tawerga in Libya, where something like 30 to 40,000 people were just forced out of the city. And I understand that in terms of the whole the whole country of Libya. It's estimated that something on the order of 400,000 black Africans, whether they were native Libyans or not, have been forced out of the country. And I don't know if this is getting as much attention as it should. One of the things that people have been mentioned in combating genocide, and I don't doubt that they are, have been the names Susan Rice and Samantha Powers. But, I mean, they were very vocal in supporting the intervention into Libya and wondering to what extent this led to another ethnic cleansing from the good guys, basically.
Well, I mean, that's always a problem when you intervene. As you say, you can my grandfather used to say, this czar is bad enough. Who needs a new one? I mean, there is that reality of taking out one despotic regime and then having another come in and even have sometimes a worse bloodletting because of the reaction against the despotic regime that had been in control.
One of the things Cambodia taught me, in fact, was that things can really get worse.
Yeah. Well, and there's so much that we don't have highlighted. I'm looking at a web comment here about Sri Lanka, 40,000 Tamils killed in 2009, and no indictment for the crimes. But here's a question maybe before we come to a conclusion here. Barbara writes, stories of genocide here, programs like this about Cambodia and Darfur and what's going on in Syria. What can the average person like me who's horrified do?
I think one thing you can do is support the creation of these institutions by demanding of our leaders that those institutions be created. And if they won't create them, vote them out of office. I don't mean just write letters. I mean vote them out of office. But secondly, I think, you know, we've got to really have very specific objectives about what kinds of institutions we need. I also believe we need to support, through an international movement, the creation of genocide prevention operations in the countries at risk.
Well, thank you, Professor Gregory Stanton. Thanks also to Congresswoman Barbara Lee and Yasser Khoury and Shivi Sak. And thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell and Christina Russo. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, who believe all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.